There Is One by Gutmann Locks. Part 6 of 6. 128. Consider, what portion does the Torah designate to the nations of the world, to the non-Jews? The Torah was given in 70 languages. The truth is available in many different forms. Every person on earth is given the opportunity to know the truth. As a person follows his appropriate path, he will lead a peaceful, kind, and helpful life in this world, and he will be given a share in the world to come. What must a Gentile do to be entitled to such a holy reward? There are 7 laws which were given to Noah. Noah was a righteous man in an age filled with violence and corruption. God destroyed the world by flood, but saved Noah and his family. God gave these survivors a relatively simple path to follow. This path will guarantee their continued survival and a share in his glorious kingdom. These 7 laws are actually 7 categories of laws, and they are 1. The prohibition against idolatry. 2. Blasphemy, speaking evil against God. Murder, theft, illicit sexual relations, eating the limb that was taken from an animal while the animal was alive, failure to establish courts of justice. These 7 categories of laws and the knowledge that God gave them to the world are all that a non-Jew need follow in order to be guaranteed a wonderful life both physically and spiritually. 129. Consider. The doctor's face sagged. He took a deep breath and began slowly. This was, without doubt, the worst part of his job. I'm sorry to have to tell you this. He looked at the charts again, somehow hoping that the situation would change. But all indications are that you have but a few months to live. The patient's face dropped. He anticipated something was going to happen, but not this. His heart emptied, leaving a cold, hollow feeling, and then it filled rapidly with the aches of remorse. He wanted to cry, but it was too late. The doctor's voice droned in the background. His own thoughts pounded against his head, drowning out the doctor's monotone. But there are miracles. But then again, it could be at any moment. His life flashed before his eyes. Each time he saw himself hurting someone, a pain shot into his heart. Each time he neglected to be kind or ignored the needs of others, his heart ached with memories. Oh, so many things I wanted to do with my life, he sobbed. How could I have wasted all of that time? By then his regrets had piled on top of each other so deeply that he lost count of each hurt. Layers upon layers, sorrow upon grief. Then he thought of the future. My God in heaven, how can I come before you like this? Panic overtook reason. He darted out of the doctor's office, running down the street screaming frantically, I must prepare, I must prepare. Who is the patient and who is the doctor? We are the patient and time is the doctor. Each of us has foolishly spent a large portion of our lives recklessly, and now time must inform us of the inevitable. It could be any moment. The true irony of the situation is that the straight and proper life is far more enjoyable in the first place. Yet, like a child chases after candy, we run after desires, even though we know that they will not satisfy. The wise person is prepared for what life and death might bring. 130. Consider, what is it like for the soul to leave the body? For the righteous, it's like a hair being plucked from a glass of milk. For the worst of us, it's like a thorn in a ball of wool being pulled out backwards, taking the wool with it. 131. Consider, the man was totally depressed. He was standing by the side of the road, speaking through the open window of my car. His wife had left him. He had no job. Each day was a burden. And worse yet, he was a burden to the world. In his words, he was totally useless. I tried to cheer him up with some words of hope, but he was firm in his belief. I left him with some optimistic thought and darted into a U-turn, happy to go on to something more cheerful. Suddenly he screamed, "Stop!" I slammed on the brakes just in time to see an extremely fast-moving car whiz by. If you hadn't called out, I would have been dead now. A few seconds ago you felt useless without purpose, and now you saved my life. From this moment on, every good deed that I do will also be credited to your account." His face lit up as the many months of depression fell away. When it's raining, we do not see the sun even though it is still there. The rain does not put out the sun. There is a dawn, and even the darkest nights do pass. No one knows what the next moment holds, and to deny hope is to deny the constantly demonstrated fact, as it says, this too will pass. 132. Consider. The rabbi from Berkeley received an urgent message from the Rebbe's office. He was to travel to a small town in Northern California and go to a certain motel. There he would find a young Jewish girl in the process of eloping with a Gentile. His job was to stop her. No easy task with someone you know, let alone a complete stranger. But the Rebbe said to go, so off it was. It was Friday morning, but he calculated that he could be there within an hour or two and spend a few hours with her and then back to time for Shabbos. On the drive north, he rehearsed what he was going to say. First, he was going to impress upon her that her family has been Jewish for 4,000 years. If that didn't work, then he was going to talk about Jewish genes and how we Jews are like we are because we marry other Jews, and about our culture in Israel and how important it is for the Jewish people to survive, and how statistics show that the children of mixed marriages follow the religion of the father. As he added to his list of things to say, he became a little more comfortable with the job ahead. The drive took longer than he thought, but he arrived in plenty of time to do what he had to do. He found the motel easily, as there were only two in the entire town, and soon he was standing at the door. One last swallow, a little prayer, and then he knocked. The door opened to a tall, handsome Gentile. "May I speak with Rachel?" The man was startled. "Who are you?" "I'm a friend of Rachel's family, and they asked me to talk with her." He let the rabbi in and called to Rachel that a friend of her family had come. Her moan upon hearing the news sent a wave of pessimism through him. She stood up and quickly sized up the rabbi. "I know. My family hired you to come take me away from my kidnapper, right?" "No." "Come on, you might as well tell the truth, because I'm going to find out soon enough." "Look, I'm a messenger of the Rebbe in New York. He told me to come here and talk to a young Jewish girl who is about to marry a non-Jew and explain to her what the disadvantages of such an arrangement are." "I've already heard them, thank you," she said as she motioned him to the door. The Gentile objected. "But he has come a long way. We should at least listen to what he has to say." With that over, they could sit down and he could begin his attempt to carry out the Rebbe's directive. He tried everything he had rehearsed, but nothing made a dent. He spoke, prodded, and explained in questions, all to no avail. He was about to give up when he realized that the day had slipped by, and he would not be able to make it back to Berkeley in time for Shabbos. He decided to take the room next to them and make Shabbos there. He ran out and bought whatever he could find and prepared as best he could for what was going to be a long 24 hours. They spent most of the Saturday together, but he was unable to break through the walls she put between them. The Gentile did become interested and began to ask questions, but she was determined to marry the man she loved. Shabbos passed, and he saw that he had gotten nowhere. Just before saying goodbye, he said the Havdalah service with them watching, the blessing on the wine, the fragrant spice, the torch of candles, and then it was goodbye. As he stood, exhausted and somewhat depressed, he said, "Well, I guess it's time to go." All of a sudden, she stood up and said, "Wait, I'm going with you." He was dumbfounded, but did not dare to say anything, as he was afraid she might just as quickly change her mind back again. He waited until they were on the freeway speeding along before he risked speaking. Finally he had to ask, "I'm really happy that you're coming with me, but I have to ask, what happened? You said no to everything I said all day, and then all of a sudden you jumped up and said, wait." She began with a smile. It was the first bit of kindness she showed him. He could see that she was even younger than he had thought. "When I was a very little girl, my grandfather used to tell me a story from a long time ago. He said that he went to visit a very great Rebbe who told him that someday someone in our family was going to need help and that someone would come to the rescue. He would give a certain sign and that whatever happened, we had to go with that person. But all night and all day I tried to convince you," the rabbi said, "and all you said was no. What did I say that made you change your mind?" "It wasn't anything you said. I've heard all that before. But my grandfather told us that if we ever needed help and a man came to help and lighted a torch or put two lighted candles together to make a torch, we had to go with that person." 133. Consider. He was praying by the Kotel early Shabbos morning. It was his favorite time of the day. The many gray, bearded men, each singing his own tune, somehow blended into a holy symphony. He was quietly singing his own song when he heard inside his head, "You are going to get blood on your talus." He looked up for a second, and seeing no meaning in it, he let it go the way of all jumbled thoughts. The next morning, as usual, he sat by the Kotel enjoying his prayers. He noticed the man sitting next to him who had never prayed with that minyan before. Suddenly the man looked up towards the top of the Kotel with an expression of pure terror. He followed the man's gaze, imagining something horrible, but there was nothing there. He looked back and saw the frightened man spring to his feet and then dive headlong to the ground, gashing his head on the stones. He was trembling what appeared to be an epileptic fit. Bending to help, he firmly squeezed the man's cheeks against his teeth, forcing his mouth open to prevent him from biting his tongue. He held him that way for some time until the ambulance came and carried him away. He returned to his prayers somewhat dazed, seeing how frail and helpless man really is. He was thanking God for his own good health when he looked down, and he was startled to see that he had gotten blood on his talus. 134. Consider. If observing a mitzvah gives joy, why is it so many Torah observant people do not seem happy when they are doing them? For instance, many people give charity reluctantly or even with disdain. The reason is that they're doing the mitzvah without understanding what's happening. Once they learn the truth about a mitzvah, they feel blessed rather than burdened. Imagine being called before the Supreme Court. The investigators arrive at your door and march your way to the hearing. You're being held for some reason, but they have not told you the specifics of your case, and you do not know what, if anything, you are being charged with. As you are walking with them, you quickly review all of your lifetime dealings. You want to make sure everything is in order so you will not be embarrassed when the judge pulls out your file and reads the particulars of your case. As you approach the courthouse, you recall a loan that was supposed to be paid back to a poor person because the generous donor who gave it to you did not need the money. You completely forgot the debt, and you know that there is a written record of this transaction in your file. This offense alone could be enough to sway a judge's decision, and with each step you become more and more uneasy. Then, as if by a miracle, you see a poor person walking between you and the courthouse. You quickly run over and, with a great feeling of relief, humbly ask the poor person to please accept the proper sum of money. The account is settled, and you breathe easily as you mount the steps of the courthouse. This is, in fact, the situation of each of us. Hashem has given us our incomes with the specific provision that at least 10% of it is to be given to charity. If, on the day of judgment, we are found to have died with their share in our pockets, we will be horribly embarrassed. It will be impossible to pay the debt, so the blemish will have to stay on our souls until we can come back and rectify it. So it is with all the mitzvot. Each has been created with the specific intention and intrinsic ability to improve our lives. When we realize this, the carrying out of a commandment will not only not be a burden, but it will bring joy to those fortunate enough to have chosen to reap its treasure. 135. Consider. The itinerant farm worker had been picking melons for 20 years. He looked old, way beyond his years, leathery, wrinkled from stooping over long rows of melons from sunup until sundown. He could neither read nor write, and his conversation centered around an extremely small vocabulary. In his entire life, he never had more than a single day's wages in his hand at a time. I walked by, somewhat pitying this beast of burden. Then I thought, what does he know better than I? After some thought, I asked him, how can you tell if they're ripe? When they stick to your fingers, was his quick reply. I moved in closer, trying to understand. He showed me that when you reach to pick a cassava melon with one hand, your fingers will slip off an unripe melon, but if it's ripe, your fingers will stick to the skin so you can grab it. I later realized that this happens to a ripe cassava melon because the sugar has come to its surface, but according to him, it's so you can pick it. I always think of this wonderful teacher whenever I eat a sweet, ripe cassava melon, chosen from a stack of hundreds, always perfect. The Torah tells us that we should learn from everyone. 136. Consider. Nava is an amazing woman. She's the kind of person who seems special, but at first I could not tell why. As we spoke, and she unfolded some bits and pieces of her life, I could see more and more what kind of person she was. That evening I was to visit a young boy whose parents had asked me to pray for him. Apparently he had some strange mental condition that made him feel like he was always in a dream, and they wanted me to come talk to him. I had asked for his name and his parents' names so I could start to pray for him. As Nava told me more and more about her life, I could see that she could probably help with this boy, or at least it certainly would not hurt. I asked her to pray for him, hoping that her merit would tip the scale in his favor. She asked for his name, and I told her the name that his mother had given me. She looked at me strangely, her face twisted, and she flatly said, "There's something wrong with that name." "How can it be?" I asked. "It's the name his mother gave to me." That evening, the mother met me at the door. She was quite harried, and she apologized. "I'm sorry, but the name I gave to you for my son, I confused his father's mother's name with my name. His name is Moshe ben Ruth, not Moshe ben Sara." I thought, that Nava is an amazing woman. 137. Consider. He was a young American visiting the Kotel for the first time. By the way he dressed and acted, I was sure that he would consent to put on tefillin. I was usually very successful with this type of youth, but no matter what I would say, he would not agree. I tried my assortment of tested approaches one after the other, but to no avail. No matter what I said, he refused. First I tried reason, no luck. Emotion, he didn't budge. Humor, no, he was not going to give in, no matter what. I was truly surprised. With years of experience in sizing up visitors, I could almost always tell an agreeable Jew, but it was as if he had made himself a promise and he was not going to break it. As I wrestled with him, trying all of the best arguments, an old man kept interrupting me, insisting on telling a story. A story? At a time like this, I thought, for sure the kid was going to slip away while this old man would go on with some tale. But he insisted. I gently held on to the tip of the boy's sleeve, trying to keep it from slipping away as the old man began. But as soon as he started, I could see that there was no need. He wasn't going anywhere. The story began. Tomorrow is my anniversary. It will be 44 years tomorrow that I was liberated from the death camp. He spoke softly, almost casually. It took a moment or two to realize the depth from which he spoke. His English was perfect, which also seemed to diminish his authenticity, as if a thick Yiddish or European accent was necessary for the story to be real. He went on. There were 8,000 of us that went in there together, and I was one of only 35 to survive. Only 35 of us. He paused, looking back into that darkness. Then he went on. I weighed 88 pounds when I got out. The day of the liberation, I found myself in the camp museum. The room was filled with exquisite treasures stolen from Jews and displayed as propaganda trying to justify their hatred of the Jewish people. I found before me unbelievable wealth, abandoned by the fleeing murderers as the Allied armies advanced. I knew that the room would be bare, looted by the morning, and I could take anything that I wanted. Right before me there was a ring, a watch, and a pair of tefillin. You must understand that these were not ordinary jewelry, but that they were taken from a very, very rich man. The ring alone was so costly, they said it was worth 34,000 days of labor. At first I picked up the ring, then the watch, but I was afraid that if I took either of them, people would think that I was a very rich man, and they would hunt me down for my wealth. So instead I took the tefillin. I want you to know that when I put them on, it felt like I grew 2 feet taller. I felt strong again, and I have been putting them on every day since. And the good Lord has kept me healthy every day since. He looked at the boy, who by now was a soft puddle. He hugged the boy and kissed him. Then he went on. Now I want you to put on tefillin. The boy merged into the old man's hands as he helped him to put on tefillin. And after you put on tefillin, I want you to come home with me for Shabbos dinner. The boy's eyes were wide open and soaking wet. He was sure that he was dreaming as the fortunate survivor led him away towards a joyful dinner and a changed life. 138. Consider, what can the new learn from the old? What can be gained by listening? Is not the new, the modern, better than the old? Are not current opinions more appropriate than ancient ones? Each person has a story, and each person has a message. In this, man is like an angel, having been sent forth from nothing to do something. The task that we have been given to come here to accomplish is the very reason and cause of creation. Everything is sent for a reason. The poorest day laborer or the wealthiest landowner, each has something to say, and the wise will learn from all. The essence of learning is listening. This is revealed in the English language by seeing the word ear in the middle of the word learn. Also, learning is not a gift, but must be earned. This can be seen in the word learning, where 7 of its 8 letters, that's 7/8 of the word, form the word earning. To know that we must learn from each person is seen in the word teach, which has each as its base. But what of the past? Are we to benefit from 4,000 years of tradition, or is each person sent to tread a new path? One need only be the first one out in the morning after fresh new snow to answer this question. All of the familiar landmarks and guidelines are gone. Each step is taken without knowing if there's a firm footing below. Is there below the covering of snow a rock or a large hole? The next person benefits greatly by seeing the footprints left behind. The more travelers, the smoother the path becomes, until there is a clear, well-defined, safe pathway. Easy as it is to see this principle when considering a bank of snow, many people today do not understand the importance of following in the footsteps of our greatest leaders. Instead, they forge strange and difficult roadways fraught with danger, ignoring or even mocking the way set before us by Moshe, Abraham, David, and Eliyahu. When Eliyahu, the prophet, approaches the modern Jew, will he fall on his face as a faithful servant who has waited for thousands of years? Or will he mock the prophet for his ancient ways? Each may choose. 139. Consider. When Yaakov, our father, awakened from a wondrous dream, he exclaimed, "There is God in this place, and I did not know it." But Yaakov knows that one of God's names is Place. So obviously God had to be in that place. He is the place. So what is Yaakov telling us? One way to investigate this question is through gematria, numerical values. In Hebrew, each letter is also a number. For instance, Aleph is 1, Beit is 2, Gimel is 3. From this we can derive numerical values for words or even groups of words. Once we know a word's numerical value, we can compare it to other words that have that same value. For instance, the word love and the word one have the same numerical value. This alerts us to look for some relationship in the words. It then becomes obvious that the nature of love and one are similar. However, without the numerical conversion, we might never have stumbled onto that fact. By computing the gematria of "there is God in this place," which is 541, we can look in the gematria charts and find the words that have the same numerical value to try to understand what Yaakov is saying. Yaakov was dreaming in Israel. Israel, the word Israel, has the same gematria as "there is God in this place." The words "the commandments" also has the same gematria, showing us that God is located in his commandments. The matzahs also has the same gematria, hinting that God is located by observing the Passover order. The word "submit yourself" also has the same gematria for obvious reasons. As the children's song goes, God is here, God is there, God is truly everywhere, up, down, all around, that's where he can be found. Although God is everywhere, it's easier for a Jew to find him in a commandment or even in a matzah. 140. Consider. In just a few years, the rabbi had gone from being a young graduate to an international personality. His work had gained great recognition. Few people in his city were left untouched by his relentless efforts. He was apparently headed for a great future when he developed a medical problem. He kept ignoring it and put off having it checked, feeling God would take care of him. But then it became so aggravated that he could hardly sit. Reluctantly, he went to his doctor, who immediately sent him to the best specialist in the field. The rabbi was shocked to hear the specialist tell him, "Rabbi, it's too late. This growth is beyond our ability to deal with." With 97% certainty, the growth was malignant and the rabbi's life would soon be over. He staggered out of the office, praying for a miracle. That very day he went to see a second specialist, who was a renowned doctor at the research hospital at the university. After a quick examination, he confirmed the words of the first doctor. This was certainly the end of life. How could such a thing happen? He thought, as he dragged home to consider what he had to do. It was unsurmountable. His wife was pregnant with their 7th child. He was hopelessly in debt. He was about to leave his family an inheritance of poverty, and there was nothing that he could do about it. It was Friday afternoon, and there was a biopsy scheduled for Monday morning. He tried to get a plane reservation to spend what could be his last Shabbos by the Rebbe, but there were no flights available until Saturday night. Oh, he moaned, how could such a thing be happening to me? He told only his closest assistants, as they had to begin to try to make some kind of arrangements. Without doubt, his work would go down the drain, since he was one of those people who did everything for himself. What little could be done. That Shabbos was strange, to say the least. Saturday afternoon, the rabbi made a party for his congregation and tried to keep a normal disposition. But in the middle of his speech, he kept breaking down. A quick reminder from his assistant sitting next to him snapped him back, but not for long. We sat there listening to him, wondering what in the world was going on. No one let out his secret. Saturday night, he spent in a plane alone with his thoughts, flying to see the Rebbe. He arrived early Sunday morning and stood next to the Rebbe's door, where he would be sure to see him on his way in. People would greet the well-known rabbi, but he had no heart to answer. Finally, the Rebbe whisked by. Then, almost as an afterthought, the Rebbe turned toward him and said, "Honorable discharge," and continued on his way. "Honorable discharge," he thought. "Oh, I'm gone. There's nothing left." He began to weep inside as he limped back to the airport to return to his wife and children. On his return flight, the finality of the situation sank in, and he began to think beyond the few moments he had left. "Well, at least it's honorable," he thought. "Surely that will count for something in the place where he is going." That thought consoled him, and he was able to sleep. In the morning, he reluctantly kept his appointment with the doctors. The exam was quick, and he was shuffled into the specialist's office. The doctors studied the reports and lab results, took another quick exam, looked again, and then, scratching his head, finally told the rabbi, "I don't understand. According to the reports and my examination, I know this is going to sound strange, but there's nothing there." "What?" screamed the rabbi. "Nothing," repeated the doctor. The rabbi flew out of his office and ran to the second specialist, demanding another examination. The doctor, feeling quite sorry for the rabbi, agreed, and after a few moments said, "I don't understand. 3 days ago you had a growth inside of you the size of a softball, and now there is nothing there. It's as if it was discharged." The rabbi danced out of his office singing, "Honorable discharge, honorable discharge, it's an honorable discharge." 141. Consider. He had recently begun the path of tshuva, repentance. He had accepted the basic tenets, but was struggling with the particulars. The rules seemed to make entirely too much of the physical without concern for the spiritual. One day he was standing in a tiny laundry in Merisharim, when two Hasidim came running in, panicky. He was already used to seeing Hasidim running around as if the bank was about to close, but these two seemed particularly upset. He was concerned and tried to follow what was going on. "Water! Water!" one cried as he shook his hands in front of the laundryman, who calmly pointed outside to a small faucet. They rushed outside and poured a little water on their fingers. Phew! They blew out their anxiety, took a deep breath, and then went on their way. "What in the world?" he cried. "That's one place I'm never going to put myself. Of all the crazy..." His mind drifted on, decrying the absolutely insane habits that Torah-observant people seemed to have made up. Some 5 years later, he was again walking in Meir Shurim when he saw a large crowd of Hasidim gathering in the street and walking toward him. As the group walked on, many hundreds joined them, coming out of virtually every doorway. He had no idea what was going on, but he moved along slowly with the crowd, edging himself towards its front center. As he came closer, he saw that it was a funeral procession. Escorting the dead is one of the most important commandments, and apparently this was a great rabbi, as the crowd had become enormous. He approached the stretcher itself and saw that one of the pallbearers was sweating profusely. He motioned, "Can I help?" The pallbearer turned over his grip, and he picked up the weight. He was surprised how light the body was. He imagined that somehow death had already taken its share, and now only the empty body remained. They placed the body in front of the yeshiva and awaited the vehicle to take it to the cemetery. His job was finished, so he slowly walked away, trying to understand death. As he moved down the street, he suddenly realized that he had touched a stretcher with a dead body on it. This was impure. He had to wash quickly. He looked around, but there was no public washroom. Yikes, he thought. What am I going to do now? He hurried into the center of Meshurim. The only place open was the laundry. He darted over and burst in. Water! Water! The man calmly pointed to a faucet. He ran over, washed his hands, and blew out his breath. It was then that he remembered those two nutty Hasidim of 5 years ago who came begging water. 142. Consider. Reb Moshe is a source of constant amazement. His love of a fellow Jew is so overwhelming that he frequently brings tears to the eyes of the men he meets. Hello, are you Jewish? As soon as they say yes, his soul bubbles up and he cannot restrain himself from kissing his newly found brother. You're Jewish. Come put on tefillin. Who can refuse such love? Most agree and are bathed in pats and hugs until their soul remembers when their own white-bearded Zaidi hugged them and told them stories about his Zaidi. Oy, was he a Jew? He would put tefillin on all day long, and whenever a Jew needed help, he would drop everything and run right over. Those who never had such a grandfather to bathe them in this kind of love do now. Are our times so busy or our ways so curved that we cannot see the good of the past and bring it with us for our own children? 143. Consider, Reb Avraham Hirsch is a gadol, a genius in Torah learning, and a source of ever-flowing kindness. To see this giant, who is well under 5 feet tall, makes the unbelievable stories of the past tzaddikim real. Watching Reb Avraham Hirsch twinkle should incite repentance in even the toughest cases. When he takes a Jew's hand and tucks it into his, it's as if the Jew were stumbling and Reb Avraham Hirsch is there to support the wobbling fledgling. Even strangers feel secure and everyone is happy to listen to his kind advice. This lesson is seen over and over again, humility and kindness. The older one becomes, the more humble and forgiving. As we see the grave approaching, we realize the wisdom in God accepting only our children as guarantors for the Torah. Nothing else, not learning, not mitzvah, not sacrifices of silver or gold, will guarantee that there will be a Torah in the world after we are gone. Only our children can do that. And this is where we must not fail. According to the census takers, from 1970 to 1985, there was a reduction in the world Jewish population of 1 million people. This is approximately 8% of the entire Jewish people. Because of assimilation, Jews are being lost, and the only way to overcome this is through increased Jewish awareness, not just physical awareness, but spiritual awareness. When Yaakov, our father, blessed his son Yosef's children, he put the younger first. The reason is that the firstborn was named Menashe. Menashe, he named him because it comes from the words, "And God has caused me to forget all of my toil and all of my father's house." The younger child was named Ephraim because this name means, "God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction." Yaakov knew that his descendants were going to go into exile, and he did not want us to forget his ways. Even if we had to be afflicted, we should still be fruitful. Once the Jewish soul has been awakened, once the mind begins to ask questions, then it only remains to be surrounded by the people who satisfy one's idea of joyful service to Hashem. To serve God without joy is not serving God, but is merely service to one's own idea of righteousness, which is in truth mere vanity. Joyless service leads to exile. Thank God we have today many righteous leaders who are examples of holy life. One must go seek a teacher, the Talmud tells us. This teacher who must be not only well informed on the day-to-day aspects of a Jewish life, but also exemplifies the kindness, humility, and joy that we imagine heaven itself bestows upon its beloved. Judge only what a Torah life does for you. Each day our life must become better and better, or we are not practicing the Torah as it was given to Moshe. Each day we must become more and more content with our lives and more thankful for such a wonderful inheritance. As we progress, our goals should broaden and include becoming a blessing for all mankind, and we should begin to mature into the righteous, kind, and humble teachers we now seek to sit by. It is my personal prayer that each person on earth should come to peace, that our holy city should be rebuilt, and that all of the Jews from all around the world will flock home, that our righteous Mashiach should come, should reveal himself now, and bring the third and final temple. And as the Torah tells us, then neither shall they learn war anymore. Conclusion. This world is a symphony. The stars, the heavens, the mystical chambers. Our feet sift through his holy sand, and we breathe his life through his nostrils. There is nothing that is not already his, for there is nothing else beside him. The drums of war, the harps of peace, the daily dance and the final rest, all are his orchestration. We are at once him and his pawns, his masterpieces and his refuge, all designed to crown his holy achievement. The world, the physical map of his spiritual dream, is our trial and our only hope. You have been shown to know that the Lord, he is God. There's nothing else beside him. Shalom. Glossary. Abba, Father. Aleph Beis, Hebrew Aleph-Bet. Aliyah, going up. Omen, let it be true. Ashkenazim, descendants of Jews who, after the expulsion from Israel, settled in Germany. Ashram, East Indian camp or settlement that houses the Guru and some of his followers. Atzilut, the world of emanation, the created reality. Ayin, nothing, unmanifest. Balagala, wagon driver. Bal Tshuva, master of return, one who has returned to a Torah observant life. Bench, Yiddish for blessing. Challah, festive bread, usually braided with three strands of dough. Chosin, a follower of a Rebbe, usually emphasizing the mystical and joyous aspects of Judaism, which stress the unconditional love of the Jewish people. Chasidim, plural of chasid. Chasidut, teaching of Chasidim, beginning with the Baal Shem Tov, which spread the joy and mysticism of the Torah to the masses of uneducated Jews in the 18th, 19th, and 20th century. Cheder, a room, children's school. Cohen, a descendant of the priestly class descending from Aaron, the first high priest. Cossack, Russian soldiers, infamous for pogroms and other atrocities. Daven, to pray. Ex nihilo, from nothing. Fabringen, a Hasidic gathering, noted for Torah discussions and singing and mystical insights. Gabai, sexton. Gaon, genius of Torah learning. Gematria, the Torah method of converting words into numbers, thereby revealing relationships between the words. Guru, East Indian, a religious leader following the Brahmin religion, more or less. Havdalah, the service marking the conclusion of the Sabbath and its distinction from the work week. Hashem, literally, the name, God, how religious Jews refer to God without pronouncing the actual name. Kabbalah, receiving, mystical aspects of Judaism. Kiddush, sanctification of the Sabbath or of a holiday made over a cup of wine. Kosher, proper, fit for use. Kashrut, correctness. Kotel, the western wall, the remaining retaining wall from the ancient temple in Yerushalayim. Matzah, unleavened bread, associated with mitzvah of the holiday of Passover. Mezuzah, the parchment affixed to the doorpost in accordance with the command, and you shall inscribe them upon your doorpost. Mea Shearim, an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood in Yerushalayim. Malava Malka, literally escorting the queen, refers to the meal following the Sabbath. Mita keneged mita, portion for portion. What one does will come back to them. What you sow, you will reap. Mikvah, ritual bath. Mincha, afternoon prayers. Minyan, 10 or more Jewish men required to form a quorum. Mitzvah, commandment, good deed. Mitzvot, plural of mitzvah. Neshama, soul. Non-kosher, improper, unfit for use. Passover, the holiday of the exodus of the Jewish people from slavery in Egypt. Rav, senior rabbi. Rebbe, spiritual leader of Hasidim. Rosh Chodesh, new moon. Rosh Hashanah, new year. Shabbos, rest, the seventh day of the week. Shlichot, penitential prayers. Seferot, the 10 graded emanations forming the limitless into the apparently limited. Sephardim, Jews who after the expulsion from Israel some 2,000 years ago settled in Spain. General term for Mideastern Jews. Shabbos, Hebrew pronunciation of Sabbath. Shabbat Shalom, literally Sabbath peace, traditional Sabbath greeting. Shabbos, it's Shabbos, Shabbat Yiddish. Shekhinah, the revealed presence of God. Shofar, a trumpet made from the horn of a ram, commanded to be blown on certain occasions. Talis, prayer shawl. Talmud Torah, Jewish religious day school. Tefillin, phylacteries, black leather boxes and straps containing sections of scripture that are bound to the arm and placed upon the head of Jewish men every weekday. Torah, teaching, the way of life, specifically the 5 books of Moses, generally the entire Jewish law, including the Talmud and later writings. Tshuva, return, especially returning to a Torah observant life. Tzaddik, a righteous person. Tzaddikim, plural of tzaddik. Tzitzit, fringes worn on the four corners of a garment, one of the commandments for Jewish men. Yarmulke, skullcap. Yesh, there is substantiality. Yeshiva, rabbinical academy. Yesh me'ayin, ex nihilo, something from nothing. Yidden, Jews. Zaidi, grandfather. There is one.com.